Welcome to the Kipu Roundtable. KRT is your distributed knowledge network. Roundtable discussions on decentralization, blockchains, and Web 3.0.
Hello, everyone. Santiago Velez here.
So excited to be back. Very excited about today's guest doing a deep dive.
How's it going?
Good. How are you doing today?
Pretty good.
Looking forward to extracting great conversations, debates, knowledge, and then having a little bit of a debrief afterwards so you and I can get our points across and see where we can find agreement or disagreement, and then try to pull in our community and broaden this discussion, widen it, and keep it going.
Yeah, we've got some good guests for the show today. And like you said, in our format, we'll do a debriefing afterwards and hopefully break that down a little further. This topic of the show is about regulation, and it's probably going to be a multi-part to cover outside of the U.S., whereas this one's going to focus on the United States regulation primarily. We've got some lawyers from the U.S., and it would be great to compare that. This is a global phenomenon that's happening, and it's not always, even though the United States might drive a lot of the action, certainly not the only country at the wheel.
The space itself is maturing, and it's realizing that this is a collision course between what has been largely an online supranational culture colliding with traditional culture, traditional law and institutions. And what's this collision mean for all of us? So I think that this is a preview of the future, that our guests are going to talk about topics that are going to affect all of us if we're going to participate in the space. And it's better to be informed and ready and have a voice in that assimilation, if you will, to the larger culture. Because as we bring people in and the digital asset space grows and blockchain technology grows, it's going to come with compromises.
With us today are two of my favorite legal professionals in the crypto space. We've had ongoing conversations for several years, and I'm excited to finally gather them together in this format and share their expertise with our listeners. It's really an honor to have them both. Lewis Cohen is a principal at DLX Law with over 20 years' experience in IPOs, startups, and other complex structured finance. He was recently named in Band 1 as one of the top 3 ranked lawyers in the blockchain space by Chambers and Partners. Donna Riddell started a career with an MBA and 20 years later returned to school for a Juris Doctor degree in law. She was the first woman to chair a U.S. exchange. She served as managing director of the World Economic Forum. She's a businesswoman, angel investor, philanthropist, and is currently teaching a course on blockchain digital assets at Fordham Law. Why don't you both give us the personal touch on your background that led to blockchain, starting with you, Donna, and then we'll jump over to you, Lewis.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us here, first of all, and really looking forward to this conversation. So I guess the most prominent thing that I did in the early 90s was I was chairman of the Commodity Exchange in New York. And we, at that time, there was a technology that was called Globex, which was a relationship partnership between the CME and Reuters, which would have trading overnight by computer. It was very elementary and just at the very beginnings of being able to provide liquidity or any kind of trading overnight. But the floor was terrified of trading overnight on a computer, because rightly so, they saw that it could eventually mean that there'd be trading during the day on a computer, which would change the flow of orders to the floor. And so having seen that technology, I realized it would only be a matter of time. Of course, the time is always longer than you anticipate until that was going to be in fact the case. And so we did a merger with the New York Mercantile Exchange. It was the first of such mergers, but it really helped inform me again about the nexus of technology and the law, and also these disruptive technologies. And this was in every way disruptive in the fact that you physically would not be standing in T plus 15 years where you had been standing heretofore for years and years and years. And so I think that in 2017, when I was introduced to the concepts of blockchain, I felt the same way, that this was really going to be a dynamic force. I didn't exactly understand to what extent, but I knew it was something I had to explore. It was the during time period of the ICOs, which I saw as a problem in many ways, as an angel investor, as somebody who has taught at the law school. And so that meant, since it was so popular and so many people were making so much money, rightly or wrongly, you really had to learn well what you wanted to talk about, because you were, again, pushing against the tide there. So I would say that was my original introduction. Then 2018, Fordham Law School approved having a course, and now we have two courses there. And our other guest, Lewis Cohn, has been generous to provide his time for the students. And so now I would say I'm pretty well immersed in the blockchain crypto world, whether it be through investing or teaching or doing podcasts or and other things in this and regulatory space.
So this is Lewis Cohn here, and it's hard to follow Donna because it's such an impressive story and resume you have. My background is a little more simple. I was a practicing lawyer at a couple of very large law firms for much of my career, working in the international space and doing capital markets and corporate finance. And around 2015, as the tail end of the financial crisis was winding up, I was asked to join the board of a trade association for the structured finance industry, where I'd done a lot of work. And we'd done a lot of policy thinking about how the capital markets industry, the finance industry generally, could respond to the financial crisis. And I stuck my hand up at a meeting and said, I think this blockchain thing's got some legs to it. And next thing I know, I was asked to lead a task force, and I fell down the proverbial rabbit hole, became increasingly interested. But one thing happened is I recognized that as a lawyer, this is a very different type of community to lawyer to, and working at a very large law firm was really inconsistent with what I saw as necessary in terms of serving this community. And it really involved, working with a lot of, more offbeat projects, solo entrepreneurs, and a whole range of people that just don't fit the large law firm model. So in May of 2018, my co-founder, Angela Ofsko-Wilson, and I set up DLX Law to serve that community and really try and establish a completely new type of law firm, dedicated to the blockchain community. That's what we've been doing for the last 3 years and having a lot of fun while we're doing it.
Lewis, you just had an article published on iflr.com called FATF and the Future of Decentralized Finance. What is that publication?
International Financial Law Review. It's a pretty august periodical, not known to the general public, but every large law firm gets a copy of most large banks and legal departments. So it's a great magazine, just not a general, general population kind of thing.
So, and this happens to be in the subject that we're here to talk today. So, and that is the FATF, the Financial Action Task Force, which has recently updated their recommendations. Can you tell us, can you give us an overview basically of what this task force is?
Yeah, so I believe FATF, or FATF as it's usually referred to, was formed in the mid to late 80s, I believe, originally by the Group of Eight countries at the time, the GA, as a coordinating body for the rapidly increasing at that time international money laundering, tax evasion, and weapons proliferation, and later, of course, terrorist financing threats that most nations faced. And the idea that the founding nations came up with is that if everyone's making their own laws, it's very easy to have arbitrage among the different countries, and nobody achieves their end goal, which is to try and really reduce illicit activity and problematic activity. And so they formed this organization, which now has, it's led by, I think, a body of about 30 odd different countries. And it has most of the major countries are members at this point. And it serves a very important role because the members have given it the authority to create guidelines that, if not complied with by member states, are potentially subject to nations that are members to severe consequences, the most serious of which is blacklisting, which would effectively make a non-compliant country out of bounds for banking activity for everyone else. So it's a heavy stick that they can wield. So although they do not make laws and they're not, you know, a nation, the guidelines that they create are, you know, quite important and quite serious and taken very seriously. That being said, the United States has been in default on some of the FATF guidelines ourselves. So I don't think people are going to cut off banking relations with the US anytime soon, but it is taken very seriously. And that's what the FATF does. The FATF has been, since I think 2014, grappling with the idea of virtual currencies or virtual assets, as they like to call them, and the entities that provide services with respect to those virtual assets, which they call virtual asset service providers or VASPs, and trying to sort of figure out where VASPs fit within their guidance in terms of the kind of regulations that would otherwise apply to more traditional banks and other money service businesses. That's a basic broad overview of FATF and what they do.
And the other thing that I would add on to what Lewis said, which is everything, of course, he says is always factually correct, is that there's if you're a country that's a member of FATF, of which most are, if there is a proposal and that becomes a rule, you really have to follow it according to the rule. You can't just say, oh, yeah, there's this new rule on VASP, but wink, wink, we're really not going to do that, because then you will go on their kind of gray list, and that subjects you to auditing and closer scrutiny. And so it is serious when they come up with rules and not things that one can lightly incorporate into their overall banking system.
I would add, I mean, nothing, especially at the international level, exists that is not somewhat political in nature, and the FATF is no exception to that. You know, there are different perspectives on how much of a threat all of this is, you know, for different countries. And so, you know, politically, the United States has been an important driver, you know, in FATF activity. There's a rotating chair presidency, I think, of FATF, and the U.S. recently had that rotating chair. They no longer do. But you cannot, you know, read anything that they do, you know, without recognizing there's, you know, there are, you know, political and economic perspectives to it, as well as, you know, the more upfront policy concerns.
It's almost like a fractal perspective where the expected behavior of member states is essentially the same behavior now that they expect of all the way down. It sort of trickles down to the users. In other words, knowing the history of a wallet, for example, is very similar to knowing the history of a container load of potatoes or whatever that comes in, and they have to do their sort of due diligence to make sure that there isn't laundering going on. And like Donna said, if it really is critical that you can't have this as, well, we'll, you know, wink, wink, we'll go along with this. It really does have to be, everyone has to do it. Or if there's back doors, those back doors become norms. They become black markets.
And a little bit also, I think, is necessary to see what has changed in 2 years in the crypto sphere to warrant some of these changes. And some of the places that they're now nodding at, i.e. DeFi, and a little bit even at NFTs. And I'll leave it to Lewis to kind of do that, if you don't mind. And then we can both weigh in a little bit on where we see there might be some ways in which to trim.
Yeah, that's perfect. I wanted to talk about sort of the evolution of the crypto space and the regulations. They've been, although I'm not sure that it's necessarily a tit for a tat, because these things have been on the burner for, I guess, a decade or so, really. But yeah, give us some of the evolution, and then we'll talk specifics.
Well, certainly, you know, when things got started and when it became clear that Bitcoin was a, you know, a meaningful force and that it was a practical way for people to move value, you know, the idea of constraining the use of Bitcoin became, you know, relevant and important because, you know, in particular, you know, it's sort of like, you know, a ship that's on the ocean, you know, you spring a hole anywhere and the whole ship can sink. And that's kind of, you know, the potential for, you know, virtual assets in our financial system from, again, a anti-money laundering and, you know, reducing, you know, terrorist financing, et cetera, point of view, if value can move freely, but when the only value was that moved freely in the early days was Bitcoin at any scale, and it's kind of, you know, near cousins, you know, Litecoin and what have you, it was relatively easy to kind of impose the financial framework for traditional assets and traditional money payments onto Bitcoin. You would have banks in the financial world, you had digital asset exchanges in the virtual world, and those were the on and off ramps in the same way you might go to a, you know, a bank to deposit your money or to take out cash and, you know, spend it. You know, you might do the same with your digital asset exchange. And so it was very clear that the digital asset exchanges themselves were going to be treated as virtual asset service providers or VAS, or functionally similar, if not ultimately equivalent, to traditional financial institutions, and that made a certain amount of sense. And sort of the debates up until some recent draft guidance was issued about a month ago, the debate was really around some more practical questions. Traditional banks are required when money is moved. So if I go to my bank at, say, Citibank, and I try and send a wire to you guys down in Chile, it may go from me to my bank, perhaps to a correspondent bank, and ultimately to your bank. And in doing so, the financial guidelines promulgated by FATF require each of those banks to keep and retain certain information about me, the transaction, the purpose of the transaction, and the destination of the transaction. And even intermediary banks along the way are required to keep that information. And that's known broadly as the travel rule. And, you know, there was a question, well, how on earth is that supposed to work if I go to my Coinbase account and I send money to a digital asset exchange that's located in Chile? You know, how does that work? What if it's not a digital asset exchange? What if it's just, you know, one of you guys' wallets? You know, how does that all work? And so people have been grappling with that question. And that's where, you know, things had been up until about March, when then the world changed a bit. Now, I'll pause there for some questions, and then we can talk a little bit about, you know, the new guidelines that in draft form that came out in March, and how they really kind of have reset the table a bit.
And maybe we'll add on also that some of the intervening things that have happened since the original proposal, we've seen a real explosion in DeFi, and I think that you know, it's very important to see the new proposal in the context of DeFi. They're grappling even before this proposal with how do we in any way, shape, or form comply with KYC AML. There are some ideas being tossed around that, and the same thing with the platforms, meaning the marketplaces and peer-to-peer that's happening in the NFT space, because we're talking about serious money that's moving, and is moving between jurisdictions. So I think that this is all being considered within the FATF proposal. And there is some you know, moment of awareness within the crypto community, like, wow, they even knew about us. Well, of course, they're global regulators, and it's not, you know, they may not have stepped in to do anything about these markets now, but they're highly aware of how it could, in one way or another, impede upon their jurisdictional issues vis-a-vis KYC and AML. and that it might contravene some of the rules and regulations that they have for the banks and the other institutions. So they are watching, and nobody should have been surprised in the proposal that they were watching.
So on that note, and this is Santiago, if we imagine a jurisdictional line, because one of the things supranational currencies or value abstractions, what they do is they kind of transcend these geographical borders and they live in this abstract space of the internet. What is the actual jurisdictional line where a regulator can say, this digital asset, this token, this NFT is under my purview? And that line, the precision around that line, I think is super important, because does it end at the VASPs? Does it end at the bank? In other words, the touch points with traditional fiat currencies? Or do they? You feel that they may have a view that they're going to intercede in the internet?
Santiago, when you say in the internet, does the in the internet include marketplaces for NFTs or protocol in DeFi that are doing lending and borrowing or money markets or any of the other diverse activities that they're doing? So I don't know what in the internet means, because these are happening within protocols that are defined, even though they may have interoperability between one lending protocol and then a DEX exchange. And the same thing for NFTs. It might be sold on one marketplace and then go and be traded between people, and then that might end up being turned from ETH, which most of them are traded in, into fiat on an exchange Singapore. I think that, I think that to characterize it as in the internet makes it too amorphous. Whereas in fact, I think there are there are venues where this happens. Even though those venues have some jurisdictional nexus, maybe a little less in DeFi, but clearly in the NFT marketplaces, these are companies. I mean, they're companies that are registered and have venture capital, and that most of them have CEOs, et cetera. So they're centralized marketplaces there. So I'll end and let Lewis jump in or you guys.
If I could elaborate, actually, because fair point, like the internet as a general statement is amorphous, but a lot of the validations of these transactions are done on compute infrastructure that's literally spread across the world. And the virtualization of this asset, the only reason we're even having this discussion is because they in some way are fungible with fiat, fungible with the touch points that these legal, whether it's FATF or whoever, they have the jurisdiction in the past, right? That there's a touch point where somehow this fungibility allows for money laundering, for terrorism activity, whatnot. So, if we were just playing games, for example, and the games had digital assets inside them, and we were just trading digital assets in game, we wouldn't be having this discussion, because that fungibility to real world value and then to be able to finance some kind of criminal activity wouldn't exist. So I guess my question, I'm looking for clarity on what your and Lewis's opinion are, is where do you think the jurisdictional line will end? There must be some clear line as to where their jurisdiction is going to end, or maybe not. Do you think that it will just extend as far into the space as is necessary to avoid that fungibility? It seems like a problem that is not logistically likely to be enforceable. I guess that's where I'm getting at.
It's a great question. And I definitely see where you're coming from. I think the first thing just to observe is that, generally speaking, the digital assets themselves, be they Bitcoin, Ether, or whatever it may be, are not regulated. So the regulations don't adhere to the digital assets, which, as you rightly observe, are really kind of everywhere and nowhere, because they're entries in a ledger that are maintained on tens, sometimes thousands or many thousands of computers. So that's not what's regulated. What they regulate are people and or businesses or companies. And, you know, there are two different questions there. One is, which is kind of the question you ask, like how far does the jurisdiction of any given particular country reach? And, you know, in the case of the US, it reaches, you know, pretty far, but it's not, you know, infinite. And the second question is what practicality can an enforcement agency, you know, do about things? Certainly for people who are US citizens and whoever have hope of returning to the US, there's a lot of jurisdictional reach, because at some point, if you ever want to enter the United States, the law enforcement is going to catch up with you sooner or later. You know, if you're based in Belarus and you never have any plans of coming here, and you know you're in a basement somewhere, it's probably hard, you know, to track you down. So I think there are some practical things to come up with. But I think the thrust of your question is really, to me, goes to the heart of what we're talking about here, which is that when it was only Bitcoin, it was a manageable, you know, kind of AML, CFT, countering the financing of terrorism, AML CFT problem. And there, the on-ramps and off-ramps largely served, together with the transparency of the blockchain itself. And as, you know, many people, you know, observe, it's probably a lot more, you know, overall better to launder money with paper money than it is with Bitcoin and other digital assets. It's a lot easier to trace. And, you know, just there's a certain irony in when law enforcement likes to point to all the illicit activity using digital assets. Well, that's all the illicit activity you caught because they were digital assets. So that's actually, isn't that sort of disputing your point? What makes, then just coming back to the point, Donnie, you made, what really has changed in the last, you know, give or take year and a half is the birth of DeFi. That's what I write a lot about in this article. And the fact that DeFi really fulfills the promise of Bitcoin from, you know, 10 years back of really allowing meaningful financial transactions without intermediaries. And, you know, people initially focused, when we said no intermediaries, on just cost savings. And boy, it really bugs me when I have to, you know, I send money to my relatives in Brazil and it costs $7. And, that's terrible. And if we got rid of intermediaries, it'd be cheaper, faster. One thing we learned, especially on the Ethereum network with the price of gas, is it wasn't cheaper at all. In fact, it was much more expensive. But what was important is that we can now do ever more complex financial arrangements and have no intermediaries. And the reason that's so relevant to FATF is because, you know, since the start of this regime, 40 years ago, whatever it was, since the start of that regime, we've always had financial institutions to act as choke points and effectively to be subcontracting out financial enforcement. So if a bank has to submit a suspicious activity report when they see something, that alerts the financial watchdogs, hey, pay attention to this. This is something you might want to look into, et cetera. The banks keep records, they have information. If a problem arises, you can go back and kind of trace the history of funds. If you don't have any of that anymore, then we're kind of in a Wild West environment. And I think that's what very understandably concerns FATF. And these are all people who are charged with protecting us, right? I mean, sometimes we, you know, in the crypto community, you can be a little negative about this and they don't get us and they don't understand. But it is important to remember that, you know, most folks in the public sector are not making, you know, large salaries. And they're doing it mainly because they believe in what they're doing is important. And I think it's always, you know, important to level set around that. At the same time, there are no good answers here because there's a fundamental conundrum. And I think that's, you know, what makes this space so fascinating. You know, people always had the ability to barter and have economic relationships outside of traditional, you know, intermediaries. However, it was impractical. The moment you moved into the digital asset space, it becomes very practical. I was speaking to somebody recently who told me about the buying an NFT from somebody in Cuba, and they have an exception that you can, the US sanctions have an exception for buying art from Cubans, and presumably NFTs was not what they were thinking of when they promulgated that particular exemption. But you could see immediately the challenges there. If I draw a little circle on a page and make an NFT and say, ooh, it's an NFT, it's worth $200,000. Well, that people, you know, people with 69 million, my circle's got to be at least worth 200,000, right? So somebody sends, you know, Ethereum transaction or maybe a Monero transaction, right? For $200,000, is that legit? Is it not legit? What do we do about that? So I think the crypto community needs to recognize that we're at a real inflection point and start to think about practical ways that both sides can kind of figure things out here.
Yeah, and I mean, adding on some of the things that Lewis said, I think that in my class that I give at Fordham, this is a class that the students love, is about being able to trace crypto. And so we do a combination of the FATF and have one of the companies that do the tracing come. And it was interesting, and this time last on Monday, we were told that most of the tracing that they're doing now is happening with the DeFi coins. And because it's much easier, and there are even now mixers there, and all of the things that people were saying was attributable to, let's just say, Bitcoin and ETH and those coins a few years ago, we're now seeing happen. Now, that may just be the evolution, but in the meantime, it spills over into other areas. And the one or two things that I think are important to take away is that the crypto community has, in the last few years, gained enormous amount of traction in institutions and in all other different kinds of spaces where you're going to have family offices, investors, banks. We've seen just so much movement in this area, and they all need to know that everything is compliant, because that's really important to that whole sector in terms of fiduciary responsibility and then taking their money and then deploying it back to their investors and moreover to back to the banks. And so I think this is important to note that compliance in the anti-money laundering KYC, BSA region is the area that's most susceptible to government overreach, I would say, in trying to some way impede the growth of Bitcoin and other cryptos in the self-custody, the more traditional philosophical areas in which people are really there to begin with, for no bad reasons, for no reasons of wanting to hide money from anything, except for to be able to take more control over their assets. And we've seen, you know, the consequences of intermediaries just this year alone. We saw the GameStop, which brought everybody's attention to intermediaries. And then we just saw the huge amount of leverage that took down the family office, which I've temporarily forgotten the name, and how that even companies such as Credit Suisse that had supposedly implemented very stringent risk policies was again caught with a gigantic loss. So I think this underscores the crypto thesis, and consequently, we need to figure out how we can keep that pure while at the same time recognizing that there are global regulators that have some say in the area.
Well, yeah, by a long measure, the most significant thing about the guidance, and again, we started going down this path. Let me just clarify. So in 2019, FATF issued updated guidance to address issues around the use of virtual assets and the way in which the more traditional AML CFT regulations at the national level should apply to virtual asset service providers or VASPs. You know, after that, as we were noting earlier, decentralized finance became much more of a thing, as even have NFTs just in the last, you know, couple of months. And so the guidance really, it does a lot of things, but it focuses most particularly on decentralized finance. And it really, as I say in the article, it takes an interesting path at addressing decentralized finance. The guidance does. It simply says, well, there is no decentralized finance. We don't buy it. FATF says, we think that if a financial service is being provided, then someone is providing it. We know how the world works. Someone's making money from it. And if someone's making money from it and someone put it together, then they need to be responsible for it. Unfortunately, that has a certain, reasonableness to it. Like, hey, come on, how decentralized is this? Aren't there a lot of people making money? And, they like anybody else can open up Coinbase and Decrypt and Block and read about various protocols and how they're worth billions of dollars. And so just like we can. So they kind of say, well, come on, you guys seem to be all making a lot of money and you seem to be pretty centralized at some point. So why don't you just take responsibility? The catch is that the reason they're making all that money is because they're not acting as intermediaries. And to comply with FATF regulations and become a VASP, or FATF guidance, I should say, and become a VASP, you will inevitably fundamentally change these protocols in ways that will make them, much less interesting. What appeals to people is the ability to interact, instantly and composably across, many different platforms at many times without having to go through KYC checks and, measuring things and doing all kinds of stuff and being stopped and asked, why are you doing this transaction? Because that's what banks do. They ask you, why are you sending this money to your friend MJ down in Chile? What's up with that? And I send money to family members. They ask me that. It just doesn't work. So the most important part of the guidance, the draft guidance, for which the comments are due, as Donna was saying, in early next week, is the broadening out of the idea of a VASP and basically saying anything that is functionally DeFi is going to have a VASP somewhere in there. And that's really the key point people need to think about.
What are the relations that you would see that as we evolved from token sales, which were regulated by the SEC, and then as the space evolved, although it's not really the same people, so it's kind of a weird characterization, but from the higher perspective, projects started looking for different ways, right? They say, well, we can't do, it seems like we can't do this. It wasn't clear, and that ambiguity was enough of a deterrent for many people, I think, who were coming into it, and they started doing these other things. They started going in other directions, and that started catching on. And then now the regulatory focus is more on, okay, now you're talking about these other areas of money laundering considerations. I noticed on the website, on the FATF website, either the same day or within a couple of days of their latest release, they also released a couple other documents I thought were pretty important that no one has talked about yet. And one of them is mitigating the unintended consequences of FATF. And the other one was on trade-based money laundering. They call it TBML. So when that's kind of where I got that potato analogy earlier, because it's a big problem. And that's what, people who are looking to launder large amounts of money, they look for opportunities. And if they were finding it easy to buy containers of consumer goods or oil or whatever, imagine how easy they'll find it to, like you said, to, oh, well, this is my new NFT. I drew a circle and here it is. It's $500,000. And I sent it to a country that's used to be on an embargo list. So.
Well, I think you're right. And then I'll let Lewis kind of chime in. We saw in a number of different situations in the last, just the US in the last year, where it was Treasury that made the biggest imprint, even though there may have been another regulatory agency involved. On the BitMEX case, which with the CFTC was involved in giving a fine, the much graver accusation was against not doing proper KYC, AML. And that is not a fine, that is a settlement. It is potentially a jail sentence, and there was a warrant out for the rest. So I think that people have seen that KYC, AML is serious, and that the governments take it in that vein. Also, Janet Yellen, in her conversations, it was about this money laundering, the bad guys, the notion that there is some nefarious activity that could happen in this zone of crypto world that would in some way harm the same basic principles again. And I think that even the overreach of at the end of the Trump administration, where it was from the Treasury again via Mnuchin for a clampdown on unhosted wallets, all had the same kind of underpinnings in it. And so I do think that that's not only that there's been a change, I wouldn't say so much that there's been a change, but there's been a real awakening at these various other agencies that were kind of laying low, not to say they weren't watching, but laying low, and people were more focused on how you get the token out as opposed to what happens in the hands of various people when the token's out.
And maybe just picking up on the original question, just who sort of, we, everybody in the US at least is familiar with the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, probably a little bit less so. Donna, you referred a few times, of course, to the Treasury Department, our current Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen. People probably in the crypto community are a little less familiar. The Treasury Department is immense and has many different groups. Two of the most relevant for this discussion is, one, the Financial Crime Enforcement or Crimes Enforcement Network, or FinCEN. And FinCEN is the body within the Treasury Department that is responsible for administering what we loosely in the United States refer to as the Bank Secrecy Act, which is really just a broad umbrella name for all the myriad regulations that apply to financial institutions and also virtual asset service providers. So FinCEN is a very important entity, and it's a part, it's within the Treasury Department. But even more significant, and you were absolutely right, Donna, to highlight this, is another group, which is called the Office of Foreign Asset Control, or OFAC, O-F-A-C. And OFAC administers the U.S. sanctions programs, of which there are also a great many. And there's a lot up on, in particular, on the OFAC website, as well as on the FinCEN website, if you want to read in detail about all our miscellaneous sanctions policies. They're constantly changing and being updated, and new people are doing things and getting themselves on the list and stuff like that. Stuff keeps changing. And also political winds, you know, grow differently. You know, are we being more friendly towards Syria, are we being less friendly, Iraq, you know, all these different regimes, and the sanctions programs change over time. And so the money or financial regulatory elements of our laws apply only to financial institutions, which includes, you know, BASPs or others, broker dealers or exchanges or people that are of a financial nature one way or the other. What people sometimes get, so me as a private citizen, I do not have any responsibilities to FinCEN. However, I do, as a private U.S. citizen, have responsibilities, as we all were U.S. citizens do, or residents, to OFAC. So OFAC, administering the sanctions laws, ensures that I cannot have any business whatsoever with, you know, the sanctioned regimes of, you know, Iran and Syria and North Korea, et cetera. And not only that, there are, you know, very, very detailed requirements about even indirect relationships, and also, of course, what we call specially designated nationals and politically exposed persons are both categories of individuals. And there are severe limitations, and those apply to each and every one of us and to each and any amount. So when you do business over the internet, for example, simply exchanging one asset for another on a DEX, you are doing business with someone. If you don't know who that person is, there is a possibility that the person on the other side that you're trading with is a sanctioned person. Either they're in a sanctioned jurisdiction, or they are, you know, have, you know, they're a politically exposed person, or especially designated national or something like that. And so those requirements apply to each and every one of us. And lest you think otherwise, Europe has very similar programs as do most other major, you know, G8 or G7 countries. So you know, one may say, well, I don't have to do any KYC. And, you know, I go to the McDonald's, nobody does KYC on me. And that's true. However, you can very easily stumble into sanctions issues if you're doing business, particularly with persons overseas. Bad people can come to the U.S. It's not like if you're in the U.S., you get a free pass. But the vast majority of those problematic transactions are faceless transactions over the internet. And again, that's, you know, a big part of what FATF is trying to address as well.
To expand upon what Lewis is saying, there have been several conversations that I'm sure we've heard together where in the NFT space, that exact analogy that Lewis gave, an artist inadvertently takes money from a sanctioned country person, or he or she doesn't even take that at all. But since they're residuals on these arts in the smart contract, that down the line it gets sold to persons that are in a sanctioned country, and now all of a sudden the artist, unbeknownst to him because of the residuals, has received this money. And so whose responsibility is that? Well, yes, there's in the United States strict liability. And so, you know, these are things that we think about, and we try, and when we're in conversations with people that are really enthusiastic, and rightly so, about selling their art and their music and getting more adhesion from their fan base, that they're completely unaware that there might be some liability for them down the line. I mean, they're selling art, right? And are unaware that these rules exist. And that's, you know, to some extent, when you remove the intermediaries in some of these spaces, or the relationship exactly with the centralized marketplace is not clear as to what their responsibility is and how they vet that, then the people using the marketplace get exposed to situations that they don't normally deal with, because they're doing other of their activities through banks, brokerage firms, or even, you know, crypto exchanges, which all are doing KYC. Well, not all. Most are in the U.S. are doing. All in the U.S. are doing KYC AML. I can't say everybody offshore is doing it as actively.
So does this boil down to a constitutional issue with regards to whose responsibility it is to enforce? In other words, a lot of these Alphabet agencies have used traditional institutions as a proxy for enforceability. We're going to pass a law, we're going to pass a set of policies, and then we expect you as banks with a chartered license that are under the jurisdiction of a particular sovereign or government, we expect you to enforce these rules on behalf of us, the sovereign, the state. And because things are moving to a peer-to-peer framework, is this basically heading in the direction that now the individual is being charged with the responsibility of enforcement and vetting of the counterparty? What are the implications? Does that fill down to a constitutional issue? What are your thoughts on that?
I'm not a constitutional law scholar, and it was a long time ago I did my con law, so I can't really answer the constitutional aspect. But I don't think that in general, the general public is yet prepared to assume these responsibilities that heretofore they're either barely aware of or had been the responsibility of banks and other centralized agencies. And, you know, if we are talking in the NFT space, there are centralized agencies. That doesn't mean that you and I can't decide to trade an NFT ourselves, but then we can also decide to trade a regular physical piece of art ourselves. And, you know, there is, as we know, in the traditional art space, a fair amount of problematic finance, I'll just call it that, that goes on there. And so what we want to do in the crypto world is to improve upon the traditional finance or traditional art, the world, and not replicate to the extent possible mistakes that are being made there, because we can learn from it, and we can try and do better. So I would just kind of leave it at that and say, you know, there's a lot of other issues that are not KYC AML issues that need to be resolved in a lot of these spaces, including smart contracts that need to be improved upon for many reasons.
So it's along that note then, is ultimately logistically, how does this express itself? Does this mean that we kind of need a identity, a general identity for our transactions on the internet that is verifiable globally so that we know who our counterparties are? So if I do go on a DEX, how do I know that that counterparty is on a sanctions list, right? If I had an identity that travels with the counterparty through zero knowledge proofs, they could prove to me that they're not on some list without me actually having to know who they are. So there's ways that they could prove that they're compliant and not give away their identity to me personally as a counterparty. Do you think that's a kind of necessary prerequisite so that as individuals, we could fully comply?
It's interesting that you raise that, Santiago, because I don't know the name of the protocol, or maybe it's just in conversation where they are thinking of being able to be in the front, you know, before you get into the DeFi space, you would have this KYC AML, I don't know what you get a tag or you get a, you know, something indicated on your persona that now once you travel in there, you've been KYC'd AML, and that would be a way to give some confidence, not only to you and I transacting together, but to the overall protocols and the other people there. So I think that people are working on it, and I think it will be a very successful protocols and will find lots of adaptation because there's a need, and the DeFi space has recognized this need because they're aware that this is an area of concern by the global regulators. And so they are trying to figure out ways in which they can be compliant without really jeopardizing the underlying benefits of the protocol and what it does and how, when expanded to include more people, that expansion will be as compliant as possible, especially when you have less professionals and more retail persons using them and benefiting from the decentralized finance protocols.
I do see, and I think I definitely want to dig down on the unintended consequences document. One of the things they list several things. De-risking is one of the big ones, right? And that's kind of the business side of it, where people just say, you know, I can't comply with these laws anymore. It's going to be too costly, so I'm out. That's not what, of course, you know, in the long run, that's not what they want. They don't want to hurt the economy. They don't want to hurt, you know, a certain their national interests. Financial exclusion is another one, you know, same idea, right? If smaller businesses can't get involved in this and we can't be decentralized down to a more local economies, you know, what's the real benefit? We're losing the biggest benefit of this decentralized technology. But this other one here was it threats to fundamental human rights, like what Santiago was asking about. I don't know that it hits exactly on the constitutional rights, but you know, they talk about due process or right to a fair trial, but it is kind of like there's some connection, I think, to the idea of not incriminating oneself. So that's an interesting connection.
Well, yeah, I mean, along that line, my biggest concern, I guess, is that certain burdens might be placed on the individual that at scale are just not practical. Now, that's not an excuse for an individual not having to comply. But if your point about if we're going to realize the benefits of this technology, we need to provide people with the tools they need to comply. And we need to provide kind of regulatory clarity on how, whatever the instrument is, a DeFi instrument, an NFT, et cetera, what are the rules of the game that will allow somebody to safely transact peer-to-peer and derive these benefits? Because a lot of people in the crypto community view this as kind of a moat, right? This is a regulatory moat that incumbents are using to protect from being disintermediated. All right, so they're saying, well, we have to comply with all these rules, so do you, but they're cost prohibitive, right? And so this regulatory moat really is a barrier to innovation. And so that's one of the chief complaints of a lot of the community. And so I think, and they're legitimate. If you think about practically speaking, how you would fund even tools for identity or fund tools for KYC AML down at an individual level, it's just not practical. So I think a lot of work needs to be done there, and a lot of communication with the regulator. So,
yeah, I think a lot of the things you say are correct. At the same time, I'm pretty realistic and practical. Coinbase went public today. That is a centralized, regulated exchange that will become more regulated and more centralized. And where did it go public? It went public on the stock market. So when people talk about some of the ideology of crypto, I mean, we have moved to a lot of centralization and a lot of regulation, and people are actually more interested, the general public, in crypto as it becomes more accessible and more familiar. Now, I'm not saying you can't push the boundaries of what familiar looks like, but people like the fact that they can do their trade on a brand name and be able to custody it on a brand name or in a brand name, i.e. a bank. And so, and also what we're seeing in the last year for sure is that centralized banking and other institutions are moving into crypto because it's lucrative, and they see now the possibilities that this startup community has proven to them. I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's a real thing. And so every day we see more and more of the traditional names coming in here and bringing it back full cycle to what this subject matter is. All of those names need to have KYC, AML, and abide by these travel rules. And so great ideas get adopted, and they get changed as they get adopted and get more adherence. And the question is always, how do you keep your basic values as you grow and become more popular and then subject to more societal norms and regulations? I guess that's the kind of central thesis and argument up to how do you create the balance? And the tension is always there.
Yeah, I think there's something to be said here also for the harmonization of law, right, at the international scale. It's the same. It's basically the same thing. Again, I go back to the fractal analogy. It's the finding consensus, say on a blockchain or in some community. Once you have that consensus, you have something powerful. Right now, the world is you know, maybe the G20 they're pretty much on the same page, but there's still a lot of other countries that are outside of this, and it's not just individuals who are you know, de-risked or unbanked and not included. It's really, there's a lot of countries, you know, who are almost entirely out of the financial loop. And but if the benefits or if the unity can be had on agreeing what kind of you know, regulations need to be applied to avoid these problems, then there's going to be a great value to that, you know, and hopefully it won't only be for the biggest players, you know, the biggest corporations on the planet, and will be a little more inclusive.
Yeah, and I think there's a kind of a real friction between kind of the philosophy Donna was referring to. That consensus, that shared state, is a way that property rights are enforced on the internet, right? So if you have a blockchain, you don't rely on kind of meets-based legal enforcement to trade a digital asset, right? You rely on the consensus protocol to do that, and that's what mitigates the counterparty risk, right? That if I send you, you know, some Ethereum, I don't really need to rely on an intermediary. I don't need to rely on brand or trust as a proxy for why that transaction is going to get fulfilled. I'm relying on a protocol that's back-ended by compute, a layer of compute that it is incentivized to do that on their own behalf. So that has an incredible amount of friction, that sense of property, that's my Ether, that's my NFT, and it's being backed by an algorithm, versus property in meat space that's backed by the law and by regulations, right? And by a societal consensus. So I think that's where the rubber meets the road, is how do you translate this kind of property enforcement by algorithm versus legal enforcement, which is the traditional norm?
Yeah, sure, that's the tension, you know, that's the tension between technology and law but, you know, we still do have a lot to work out in this huge startup space. I mean, we did allude to the high gas fees now on the Ethereum blockchain. And if one of the key underpinnings is to be able to have more access for the unbanked, they're not going to be able to pay these kind of high fees. Wasn't part of the rationale that the unbanked, or even the people that are banked in the US that pay the highest fees at the banks, at the credit card companies, at the cash your paycheck places, that they would be able to benefit, and those monies in fees that they pay would be so greatly reduced that it would increase their monthly spend in for themselves and not for intermediary institutions, which in fact, you know, kind of pay gouge, out their fees from the people that need the money the most. So whether it's remittances or any of these other things that I alluded to, at the same point right now, the utilization of these blockchains are heavy. And, you know, I guess if I were going to prioritize, do I want people to have access to their money with lower fees, then that would be a greater priority. If somebody is working and sending money home to their family, whether it be in South America or in the Philippines, where we have so many workers that are, you know, domiciled in Dubai or in the UAE and in Saudi, in all over Asia. Yes, I want the money to go to their families and not to the intermediaries. So what does that mean? I just made this up now. Should we tax the other transactions that are for other purposes, i.e. art or music? Should there be a tax that is the social good tax? And so some of the fees on the Ethereum blockchain go to subsidize the people that really need it for their livelihood, and to reduce those fees that we all agree that they should really have, less of a burden. So I just raise that issue. I mean, people are donating parts of their gains in the sales of these NFT to charities. Maybe we need to donate it to a fund where people that really could benefit from crypto could benefit from lower transactions for improving their standard of living, having access, as we said, to banking facilities, et cetera, that this would really, really make a step forward. And maybe that would be, you know, some positive element that could convince the regulators that these transactions have not only nefarious possibilities, but we could show them the really positive side of crypto for the unbanked, for saving transaction fees for the people who need to save the money the most. Otherwise, it's just a bunch of financial services guys trading.
It's the most beautiful irony in crypto, is that it set out to be a peer-to-peer movement, and it's now becoming a collateral layer for store value of the wealthy. And, you know, the security premium that proof-of-work blockchains like Bitcoin and Ethereum is basically crowding out small transactions. You can't use it for remittances. And so they're being forced to adopt layer two solutions, which always come with compromises and security flaws and things like that. And it's doing exactly what we weren't supposed to do, right? We were supposed to bring people in versus exclude. So I'm actually hopeful that there's other consensus protocols that are more efficient, that don't rely on proof of work and don't have that de-escalation problem. And we're seeing that and these generation three blockchains. I think that that's where we'll see those use cases borne out. So it makes perfect sense that right now the majority of the institutional adoption is in the proof of work consensus protocols, because at the end of the day, they're going to be the only ones who can afford it. You know, to do a transaction at large scale, you either batch it with a bunch of other small transactions and layer two, or it's worthy. It's $20 million transfer and you're fine paying $50, $100. It's very ironic.
I think that there are ways that we can work together to find wallets for, you know, get set up wallets for people in the unbanked, people that want, that need to reduce their fees, and start to fund some of those wallets with some Satoshis. And those individuals will then see those Satoshis grow in value. So even though you said about the store of value, but they would then have something that grew, and they would be able to see the value of being involved in crypto and why it could ultimately benefit them. So I do think the haves, and especially many people became even more wealthy over the last, whatever it is now, 10 years plus of Bitcoin, they can use some of that gain to support what's the some of the thesis of Bitcoin is. And I think then we'll see a real strong adoption globally, because people will really feel wealthier. The person that doesn't have access to a bank will feel wealthier because they will be. And I think that that's an important thing. So I do think that giving is the greatest good that we can do in this crypto community. And I think people need to think about those values in light of all of this, which is a big step away from what we were talking about originally, which was regulation. But I think it's an important point to underscore that, you know, we need to get back to our philosophy and our grounding. And as the prices go up, remember other people need to benefit from that as well.
It'll be interesting to see what the comments are as far as the feedback that the FATF receives. And hopefully this will be, you know, maybe we can draw some attention to the one on the unintended consequences, because, you know, back and forth, we've hit on this several times now, sort of unintentionally ourselves, that, you know, the NGOs would be one of the people that would probably be the first to opt out. I was on a project that, you know, basically was tanked to try, because of it would have had to meet these regulations. And I remember it was around maybe $7 or $8 per user to comply. And that's just, you know, if you need to get into the millions to be into a sustainable network, then that's, you know, you better have a lot of money. So anyway,
let's extend our thank yous to our two great guests. Lewis Cohen, you can catch him on Twitter at NYCryptoLawyer, all one word, and also at dlxlaw.com. And Donna Riddell, you can also catch on Twitter at Donna Riddell, R-E-D-E-L. And also check out her course information at fordham.edu. That's fordham.edu. Be sure to check out all those links, including the article we talked about, on our log. That's medium.com/Khipu-roundtable, Khipu-roundtable.
Yeah, thank you to Lewis and Donna for coming on the show and bringing your insights. We really appreciate it. We hope we'll have you back soon and things are revisited.
Yeah, pleasure to be here. And yes, this subject is not finished. So I'd be happy to come back and discuss it after the letters come in on April 20th from various letter writers and institutions globally. And then on the next round that FATF looks at the proposal and makes some commentaries.
Yeah, no, thanks guys for having us. It's a pleasure chatting with you. These are very insightful questions and you do a great job. Don, as you say, we have only just begun to scratch the surface of these issues, how they will impact the crypto community. And this is of, you know, I know sometimes regulation seems a little dull, but this is of the utmost importance for anyone who cares about the crypto space. Thank you.
So a lot of heady stuff. Santiago, what are your thoughts?
This is serious stuff. There's things here that I don't think I personally considered myself. So I'm greatly appreciative of the guests coming on. You know, the implications of all of this compliance being brought down to the individual level. I think thus far in the evolution of blockchain, it's been very this free mentality, the peer-to-peer, the freedom that comes with the power this technology delivers and none of the responsibility. And so what we're really talking about here is what comes along with that power, what comes along with that freedom. Is there a responsibility of the individual, a self-sovereign individual, to comply with the rules and regulations of societies that are in kind of the real world meat space, as I refer to it. I think that has profound implications. I think for now, we've been in this, I wouldn't call it immature, but there isn't the level of personal responsibility in the blockchain space that I think we're being forced to kind of grow up and realize that we are dealing with heavy technology, heavy implications of the use of that technology, and individuals are going to be asked to carry that load. And there is going to have to be a discussion, right, between the individuals in society and the society itself as to what is the right ratio, what's the right burden, and who should do what. And I don't think there's a final word on that.
Yeah, a lot of these kind of considerations and worries are echoes of what we saw, for example, when the internet came around. Well, look at all the crimes that are going to be committed and broadcast, and some of them have come true, but you know, the world goes on. And in the meantime, the entire, you know, industrialized world and business has adopted the internet and made use of it, made good value of it. And, you know, even though I think if I'm not mistaken, pornography is still the number one use of the internet. I'm not sure if that's still a true statistic or not, but you know, and so people that were concerned about that, well, did it grow? You know, did it get bigger? Maybe not necessarily, but it got, like everything, it got easier to access. But we have to be able to take the good with the bad, and we have to use technology and keep up sort of an arms race, as it were. To use the technology to find other ways that don't prevent access and distribution of these benefits to everyone. You know, if they're concerned, and I think that's one of the things we need to find out really, is we need to examine more, what are we trying to prevent? I mean, there are some obvious ones, terrorism, child trafficking, but are some of them maybe insignificant and maybe not worth the big expense? There probably is a lot of refinement that could go on. I mean, obviously we need to combat really the worst of these crimes, but at the same time, as our guests made mention, for the most part, I think that these transparent technologies are going to make things, at least some enforcement, easier.
I agree with that. The thing that I found interesting, me personally, during the roundtable, was I found myself getting somewhat emotional regarding certain topics I'm personally passionate about. First of all, is kind of the division of responsibility. Who's specifically responsible for what? And then what does that mean in terms of personal rights? And we've seen a lot of passion in this in the crypto space, particularly in regards to insinuations that things like the Stable Act, we're going to make individual node operators responsible for, you know, an illegal smart contract or something like that. And that really riled up the community of that, those kinds of implications. And I found myself, when listening to the the guests, getting a very similar emotional reaction that, you know, and they were excellent guests. This is not a criticism by any means against them or their what they presented us. In fact, I'm very deeply appreciative, but I was surprised at my own personal reaction that what are the implications? And you alluded to it earlier in what you just said, that when you say we, you know, we are responsible for enforcing terrorism, or enforcing anti-money laundering, enforcing X, Y, and Z. And I have to push back a little bit about that, not because I think we don't have a responsibility as individuals in our society, I certainly do, but that I think to some extent, the traditional banking industry has been made a proxy for the enforcement arm of the government for a long time. And I think that making the job easier for a regulator, for an enforcer, is not the role of the citizenry. The citizenry is here to live in our society in peace and kind of enjoy their rights fully, a right to privacy, right to transact, right to barter, right to express value as they see fit. And I personally find myself listening to what theoretically could occur, that the situation where now the individual is burdened with this enforcement. And I that's something I'm not quite ready to accept philosophically, right? That just because the banks or other financial intermediaries decided to accept that because they made a calculus at some point in time that it was in their financial interest to do so, that we're gonna help the regulator and the enforcer do their job to find the bad guys. They made a calculus that, yeah, it's worth helping the government do that because we can keep doing our business. I'm not so sure that that calculus is appropriate for the individual. And so I find myself listening to it and getting passionate about what the potential implications are. And to the extent that the devil's bargain, if you will, it's if you don't do this, if crypto community, you don't accept this proposition, then the guys with the big money aren't coming, right? That's the implicit devil's bargain. If you want big institutions to bring in significant amount of liquidity, purchasing power, et cetera, to digital asset space, then you better get with the program because they're not going to. They're not going to buy large amounts of Bitcoin and store it on their balance sheet unless they can comply. And therefore, if you want to be a beneficiary of that value in some capacity, you better start getting with the program too. And you know, one of our guests did perfectly allude to, yeah, this is the process of assimilation, right? This is the process that when you have a kind of fringe, a section of a society like what crypto is, begin to become normalized and incorporated into the general society, there's compromises potentially that have to be made to your values. So I really enjoyed the conversation because that to me, it gets to some really fundamental questions. That's one of the reasons I brought up the question of constitutionality, et cetera, and who's responsible for what. But I wanted to get your thoughts on that, how that made you feel and what you think those implications are.
We share some wavelengths there. For one, when the banking industry, in fact, we talked about this a little bit, we hit on this analogy in the introductory episode, that you know the banking industry is a decentralized network in itself. It goes from central banks out to these member banks. Everybody in the system is a member, and they've signed on, they have consensus, they have harmony of their rules, they have interoperability, and they are well paid to do that, right? They are well-paid utilities of our public society. And so, of course, the government has a great amount of leverage to say, hey, you know, life has been getting more complex over these decades. We've got these terrorists, we've got the drug kings, and, you know, we've got these reasons that we need to step up more enforcement, and we need you to play a role in that. And I think it went along and it was fine. And now, you know, what we're seeing here is the disruption of that banking system. I don't see it going away. I don't know if I've said it before on the show, but I think we're gonna basically go through a bifurcation of sorts. It's not going to be an either or. There isn't going to be a replacement of the status quo, at least not for generations, you know, to come. So we're going to see both. And so then, yeah, that's that question. Is it a legitimate ask to put that kind of regulatory burden on an individual? I would say no. And in fact, I think
probably, I mean, both hopefully and I think I intellectually believe that this is going to happen, is that we're going to see some limits, something like we already see with AML. If you go buy a coffee, no, right? There's the, you know, if even you buy new clothes, new tires for your car, no. But you start buying a new car with cash, then car dealerships need to step up and say, okay, yeah, if we're going to accept large amounts of cash and in our business, you know, over this, let's say that's $10,000 limit or whatever, then yeah, I could see where kind of like that's where the leverage comes in, you know. So and it's kind of it's pretty similar to what rules we're already all dealing with. You know, you can't just show up with $1 million and deposit it in your bank account without answering some questions of where that money came from. They do apply human reasoning to those situations. They fill out a form, they have to ask some questions, they get to, you know, find out where it's from. But when you start automating that and you start having these distributed networks, I'm not sure how that's going to work. And that's kind of why I said, I think at that point, we need to find out, we need to maybe refine what it is we're trying to prevent, you know, because I don't think there isn't just going to be this easy kill switch that prevents all crimes from happening magically because we have somebody's ID. They're still going to make fake IDs. They're going to have their own little networks that the mafia and those kind of organized crimes have always had their dupes and whatever else they call them to stand in, you know, take the heat for them to have clean records. And that's, I can't see that changing either. So yeah, there's some uneasiness and a lot of tension coming out here with these responsibilities.
And I think you hit the nail on the head with the kind of kryptonite of crypto, right? The kryptonite of crypto is that it doesn't settle obligations. It doesn't buy you your tires for your car. It doesn't pay your mortgage. It doesn't do these things that in the real world, the meat space, we need done, right? To pay for things. So until that point, until you have goods and services and obligations denominated in digital assets, the touch points are always going to be where the regulator leans in on, because that's where it's just easy, right? It's the low-hanging fruit. You can touch upon the Coinbases of the world or the Krakens or whoever that fiat off-ramp is, it's just very simple, because you know that at the end of the day, if it's the terrorist and they're going to go buy themselves groceries or AK-47s, you know where that money is, and you can put a pressure on that. But to your point, you know, we already have money laundering, and cash is still the largest source of money laundering, and banks are still the source of largest money laundering. So is this kind of a solution in search of a problem, right? Is this just because this is the way we've always done things that we expect compliance to this level of rigor, this regulatory burden? We've always done it this way, so therefore we're gonna force fit this model into digital assets. And is it because digital assets are growing so fast and the space is getting so big that we see this as getting out of control? What does that mean to be out of control, right? If the regulator feels they're out of control, what are they actually talking about? Are we gonna have a proliferation of terrorism or drug trafficking beyond what we already have now? I'm not so sure. I'm skeptical of that. That's the insinuation. That's the constant theme we keep going back to, that if they don't control this, that we're just going to get a proliferation of crime. And I tend to approach it from, well, I'm going to presume everyone is innocent and respects their personal privacy to transact until proven guilty. And that's why I alluded to constitutionality at the beginning, right? Is that I should be free in my effects and papers to transact with you in wherever country you reside, and nobody should be privy to that. And I don't see why there needs to be a regulation necessarily. I do see in the greater good for society that if these problems become systemic, then yes, you have to take action, but that's an enforcement responsibility. That's not an individual responsibility. And you know, the danger is you crowd out there. We talked about inclusion at one point in the episode. We're going to bring in the unbanked. And what you really do by raising regulatory burdens is you crowd out the unbanked. Are you telling me that someone in a developing nation is going to always have to verify who their counterparty is on a DEX before they can take a loan. That just doesn't seem credible to me or in alignment with the mission statement. So
one last little pushback is just even the term unbanked, I think, is one of many that hopefully we'll take apart in future episodes. It's used for something that's really not what people usually intended to, because we've heard people say that, you know, be your own bank, right? That's a powerful statement. That's what blockchain enables. But there's another side to that, which is simply not everyone wants to be their own bank, right? Not everyone wants to jump through these regulatory hoops. Not everybody wants to be responsible for liquidity or for the attention that's required, customer service, all the stuff, you know. But some people will. And so we just need to accommodate that. And I think that really financial inclusion is good. Banking the unbanked is a catchphrase that kind of basically says it's like a trap, because it's what it's saying is the micropayment problem that's existed online on the internet. This is one of the problems that cryptocurrency solves, is because it brings the cost per transaction down, or it has the potential to. Obviously, there's transaction fees that have bloated networks can raise new problems. But compared to the legacy system, where, for example, like I threw that one figure, maybe between $7 and $8 to comply with, you know, AML and KYC, that's just those laws. There's other things involved as well. I mean, guards and vaults and security and employees and you're talking about a very large overhead for those kind of businesses. And so they can't, the simple fact of the matter is that the legacy banking system cannot offer banking to poor people who don't even have money, right? We're talking about an entirely different problem. We're talking about financial inclusion. We're talking about cryptocurrency coming in, creating value with the community from the get-go, replacing bank loans, replacing those things, and letting them spend that money in their networks on a local basis, never touching the legacy system, and thereby avoiding a lot of these requirements. And I think that's what I mean by the bifurcation. I think that, like it or not, what we're really seeing is, yes, banks are adopting this, even nation states. We're going to see a lot of that, just like we saw with the internet or telephones or cars or anything. Any kind of technology, yeah, of course, our government's going to adopt it and they're going to gain efficiencies. But that doesn't mean that we're all going to drive tanks or we're all going to be driving around with satellite phones in the 90s, right? Those were things that, you know, military agencies might have had. So the technology has to adapt to different crowds. And I think we'll find hopefully a lower watermark, you know, for average people to do day-to-day transactions and bring in new wealth, or at least, you know, new tokens of value into communities that are stuck because the legacy system has left them out, right? Out and they fell into the cracks. Trying to bank them, that's not going to work. And neither is becoming a bank with cryptocurrency and then trying to go out and bank them. That's still going to be the same problem, because now you've added all the cost to the legacy, you know, and you can call yourself an alt system. But if you're just an exact duplicate, just smaller, new people, that's one of the common things you're hearing around crypto conversations now is we're just replacing, you know, the old elitist guard with some new people, but we're kind of duplicating the same system, and that is happening. So, but that doesn't mean that's the only way. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the program. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, and if you liked it, give us a positive rating. Find all our links, articles, and episodes at kipu-roundtable.net. KHIPU-roundtable.net